The Hawaii Government Employees Association represents close to 28,000 active members, as well as more than 12,000 retirees. It's closely watching the outcome of lawsuits filed on the mainland by some groups looking to claim back dues following the recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court on what's called the Janus case. That ruling, tied to First Amendment arguments, allows union members to opt out of paying dues. This summer, that subject dominated the union conferences. HGA union leader Randy Pereira just returned from a gathering on the mainland. The union is a member of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. He sat down to talk with us about the impact the Janus decision may have on Hawaii unions.
As anticipated, we've received some calls from individuals who are looking to opt out of their membership, but in consultation with our fellow unions like the HSTA, the UPW, etc., we're not seeing tremendous numbers of people. There are calls, of course, but there's no rush, a stampede of people trying to opt out.
And then there was a bill that the governor signed into law, which sets up a process for folks to, I guess, opt out.
Right. So you're referring to what is Act 7 from this past legislative session, and that identifies a specific time frame during which people have the opportunity to opt out. We're getting a number of calls about that explanation and honestly some upset from those who may not be in that window period when they individually would be able to opt out. But that is the law now, and we, along with the other unions, are implementing that process as would be required.
So the state initially said they were waiting for lists from the unions as to, you know, who their members were exactly, because the state really doesn't keep track like that.
That's correct. But actually, those lists were provided immediately, I believe, by all of us on the day of the Janus decision. So there may have been a lag time for the state in particular to get that information, but we provided it immediately because we were, of course, anticipating the decision that was pretty well publicized. And we had the letters prepared. All we had to do was date it and sign it and basically provide the digital information to the employers as to who was in the organization and who had voluntarily not joined.
And so you represent a broad spectrum of government employees. You think then that the units that are lower paid might be opting out?
I think there'll be a number of reasons that individuals may make a choice to opt in or to opt out. Economics certainly could be a factor for some folks, and no doubt the right-wing people will be pushing that as one of their suggested arguments to individuals suggesting that they quit their union membership. But I don't think there's any rule of thumb. I think for the most part, people who are working for government do see some value in the unions that represent them. They do know that they shouldn't be taking the benefits that they have for granted because, frankly, people before them sacrificed to get those benefits. And it shouldn't be such that you can just expect that the government, even government as an employer, is going to continue to give what you need. A perfect example, the government does not subject itself to the minimum wage law. So we still have over 2,000 employees in state government that don't make $15 an hour. And despite all the political rhetoric about it, that's going to be a continued fight. And I think people know and they don't take those things for granted. So I think they see value in their union membership.
Do you have concerns at all that there will be more tension within the units because somebody may be paying and somebody doesn't, and yet the union is providing a service to represent them?
That may prove to be the case in a number of workplaces. Certainly, there's a lot of discussion and controversy about individuals who would choose not to pay, yet would participate and take advantage of the services that are provided. And in some cases, what we may find are some of the individuals who choose not to pay are the ones who are always needing the help because they're always in trouble with management. So clearly, I trust that will cause some level of resentment.
And what about the message, I guess, that the union is trying to, I guess, reinforce to its members about why it's important to have a union?
This goes back for us a couple of years. We began, I don't want to call it a campaign, but certainly kind of retooled our efforts at HGEA a couple of years ago when we were facing the Friedrichs versus the California Teachers Association suit that was then pending in the U.S. Supreme Court. Well, that decision ended up in a 4-4 deadlock and in effect, no change in the law. We've been working a lot harder to make sure to educate employees, particularly newer ones, about the value that the union provides both directly through our bargaining as well as representation services, but at the same time, the additional value added that we can offer through our membership, whether it be in discount programs, scholarships, etc. So we've been working a lot harder to do just that and also be more visible in workplaces and ensure that people are treated in due process, et cetera. So it's an ongoing effort and something really that for, frankly, we should be doing.
No, you folks started that campaign. We are HGA. You expect you'll be continuing that and maybe more on point with a message about why the unions are important?
Well, certainly. And I think what we will continually try to do is improve what we offer, improve the services that we provide. We've improved our response time through some internal changes. And we're going to continue that as just a normal course of doing business. And at the same time, realizing that with generational change and different kinds of people coming into the workforce, it's going to take different things to continue to keep them interested in union membership. So some of the issues that unions are now really having to take a hard look at, where perhaps we hadn't in the past, but housing, the cost of housing for individuals because people are just priced out of Hawaii, as well as the cost of childcare.
We just saw Local 5 put out an interesting proposal. They teamed up with a group to explore this whole mortgage thing, and under that deal, I think the hoteliers would opt in on a trust fund, establish a trust fund to help their employees. Are you looking at something like that?
Well, for us, I think in the government sector, that might be a little different because it basically, for us to implement the same, it would require government to be paying in, which would require legislative action. You know, we're open to a lot of different ideas on our own. Over the years, we have worked with different mortgage companies to offer perhaps better rates, lower closing costs, what have you. But to be establishing a trust fund would be a little bit steeper climb for us because it would require ultimately taxpayer money.
Where are we at with the labor contracts?
All of our units are in the process of gearing up to negotiate new agreements that would begin July 1st, 2019. So every time there's a gubernatorial election, the process moves a little bit slower because the chief executive for the state's going to change. So we've begun the process, but things won't get into full swing probably till later this year, if not early next year.
There was a lawsuit filed by a handful of teachers from California who are trying to get all the dues that they paid in over the past several decades. It's a class actions lawsuit. How are you looking at that?
Well, frankly, our international union, AFSCME, is taking the lead along with the National Education Association and the SEIU to defend on that issue. The right-wing folks are relentless, and they're just not going to stop. This is more of a political battle than it is an ideological one. And they're basically trying to break the backs of labor unions as supporters of the Democratic Party. Witness the president's tweets. As the Janus decision was issued, he was tweeting how it was going to hurt the Democrats. This lawsuit, to me, is frivolous. It's an attempt to suggest that what was allowed under the U.S. Constitution over a 41-year period from 1977 to present, all of a sudden just never existed. And the premise that they're suggesting is that it should never have been considered constitutional in the first place, so therefore we were entitled to back dues. Well, that's a load of crap to me. As far as we are concerned, we're on solid ground. For 41 years, ABUD was the law of the land. This court decided to change that. So on a going forward basis, the rules have changed. But you can't undo history like this lawsuit is trying to do.
Do you expect there will be some challenge here locally?
I anticipate that outfits like the Freedom Foundation or the National Right to Work Legal Defense Fund will continue to pursue litigation throughout the country. As I said, they're relentless and they're very well funded by the super rich. So I would anticipate challenges of some kind in Hawaii, whether people challenge the opt-out process, whether people challenge different facets of employment. It's coming, sadly. It's coming.
Historically, Hawaii has been a pretty strong labor state, but that has actually eroded. How do you look at this decision going forward?
Well, for one, I'm not so sure that Hawaii's positive reaction to working people and their unions has eroded, as you suggest. You know, certainly the numbers have changed a little bit as the economy has changed, and you get different kinds of jobs in the marketplace. But I think overall what we can anticipate, while Hawaii will likely never be the hotbed of anti-labor kinds of activities that you'll see somewhere in the Midwest, for example, where there's a decidedly more conservative population, I think you can anticipate additional challenges and continued effort by mainland groups to try and come and influence how we in Hawaii are supposed to act and think.
And so how are you folks looking at the attempts to organize a constitutional convention? Do you think that works for you or works against you in this climate?
Well, the issue of the Constitutional Convention comes up every 10 years, and you know, certainly it's one that draws a lot of interest. We're particularly concerned at this point in time because it's happening at the same time that the conservatives are pushing for a national constitutional convention to revisit the United States Constitution. I have, and our organization has long believed, that the framers of our Hawaii Constitution did a good job. And in the Constitutional Convention back in the 70s that established land use laws and other civil rights for all of us here in Hawaii, they did a particularly good job in establishing Hawaii as a progressive, forward-thinking state. I, for one, am very concerned about the possibility that, given the national climate and given the potential for outside money to come in an attempt to influence our thinking, now's not the time. And I don't think there's any overarching reason that anybody has presented to suggest why we should be opening up our Constitution in total for change. There is a process through the constitutional amendment process to make changes. And that, I think, is sufficient. It's a very troubling time in our country, and I would argue it's not the time for us to be trying to revisit what the framers did many years ago here in Hawaii.
Anything else that you think would be important to underscore just from the union's perspective in this decision?
Well, for all of us, the path is clear. The rules may have changed because the right-wing folks and the rich have made their impact, but the bottom line remains that organizations like the HGEA will continue to fight to protect the rights and benefits of individuals who work for government. We're not going to lose sight of our responsibility to ensure that people that work for government get a fair shake, the same kind of shake that they should be entitled to working anywhere, you know, private sector as well. So, hey, we're going to adjust, we're going to thrive, and we're going to keep fighting.
Okay. Randy Pereira, thanks very much for joining us.
No, thank you.
That was Randy Pereira of the Hawaii Government Employees Association. And earlier this summer on The Conversation, we heard from other government unions representing university professors and firefighters. Are you a union member? Share what's on your mind. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, hau ukawai o ahu umulokai ulanai umau ukahoolawe o Hawaii.
For today's quiz, we're thinking about the famed satirist and world traveler Mark Twain. Prior to the publications of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Twain traveled the western United States as a journalist and travelogue writer. In 1866, Twain visited both Oahu and the Big Island on assignment and detailed life in Waikiki and Kilauea, respectively. His stories recount moonlight rides across the beach on horseback, the eruptions of Kilauea, and even Twain's own misguided attempt at surfing. He even documented a crucial event in Hawaiian history, the funeral of the king's sister, Princess Victoria Kamamalu. Twain's 25 letters about his time here served as some of Hawaii's earliest and most colorful tourist literature. For today's quiz, we want to know what newspaper commissioned Mark Twain to write a travel series about the Hawaiian Islands. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, Moyer Financial, and Kaiser Permanente.
HPR's political reporter Wayne Yoshioka has been poring over campaign spending records as this week marked an important deadline for candidates to file. So, Wayne, what jumped out of these records?
Well, the Hawaii Campaign Spending Commission report that came out yesterday noted that $8.5 million has been spent on the gubernatorial and the lieutenant governor's race. And what everyone is focusing on, of course, are the spending by the super PACs. BeChange now reported spending about $330,000 on television, radio, and mailed advertising, supporting challenger Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa, and also committed another $300,000 in advertising opposing incumbent David Ige. So that money is really infusing a lot of speculation on, wow, look at who is going to win this race. And to put everything in perspective, though, we have to look back in 2014 when then-Governor Neil Abercrombie spent $4.9 million on his reelection campaign. And a relatively unknown state senator from Pearl City, David Ige, spent $447,000, less than 10%. He was outspent by Abercrombie 10-1, and he won the race with 66% of the votes and over Abercrombie's 30%. So, I mean, is that the impact of all this money? Will there be a lopsided sort of return in terms of their investment? So we're all waiting to see what happens.
Right. And I know, though, with the super PAC that we saw during the mayor's race, PRP, they pumped a lot of money into a negative campaign against Cayetano, and he lost.
Well, yeah, but that was a one-issue race, mm-hmm. I think, because of rail transit. And, well, Colleen Hanabusa tried to also make this a one-issue race in terms of leadership from the January 13th false missile alert. So if it is a one-issue campaign, then, you know, it might work. But there are a lot more issues right now, and I think David Ige has gotten away from that, especially getting the endorsement from Big Island Mayor Harry Kim and all of the eruptions there, as well as Kauai Mayor Bernard Carvalho with the flooding. So it's more than one issue, and I think the impact of the super PAC money and focusing on that January 13th false missile alert might be a little too late.
Right, but now what about the other races? Because these super PACs are also funding other elections.
Right. Be Change Now, the Carpenter Super PAC, committed more than $471,000 for State Senator Josh Green, who is running for Lieutenant Governor. Josh Green has spent already $1 million, and he's trying to portray himself and get that name recognition. And I think the Super PAC did a great job. They invested early in the campaign, started out in May, and, you know, really outspent all of his competitors. But talking to State Senator Josh Green, I wanted to interview him on Super PACs, and he said, nope, I refuse to talk about Super PACs. That's in the past. I want to focus on the future. So he does not want to address that. Probably, and I'm speculating here, he's worried about maybe voter pushback when the voters say, you know, Josh Green, you're going to be indebted to these Carpenter Union folks, and we don't want that. So we're going to vote for Jill Tokuda. And Jill Tokuda could turn around the election based on the maybe 75,000 to 100,000 votes left to be cast August 11th, primary election day.
But talk about that with Jill Tokuda, because she lost her position as a Ways and Means chair over a transit issue.
So. Right. And she has made some really tough decisions to her credit. But, you know, she really didn't capture the essence of what the other state senators wanted to do, which was to fund rail. And they didn't want to have this fall through the cracks. So I think Jill Tokuda is tough. She's a fiscal conservative, as she says. And I think she would she brings to the table someone who is worried about spending. And even in that rail issue, she fell on her sword. So, you know, just to say that, no, we're not going to do the transient accommodations tax. And she was really adamant about that. So we'll see how that works out.
I think you and I were both at that very strange press conference. We were waiting for a big announcement, and it didn't come. And then we found out she lost her seat. But some might see that removal of her, the ouster, and the commitments by these PACs as a way to punish her because of her vote.
Probably, yeah, to punish her for her votes against rail. But we all have to remember that Josh Green, Kauai Mayor Bernard Carvalho, Willis Sparrow, and Kim Coco Iwamoto, they all want to be lieutenant governor, not to be lieutenant governor, but to be governor, right? That's right. That's the ring.
Right,
that they all want.
That's the plum at the end of the day. Just
wait
it out.
That's right.
Anything else? Any other takeaway that you've been able to glean just from poring over those records?
No, I just wanted to put everything into perspective. Another perspective that we can look at was in 2014 when Brian Schatz outspent Colleen Hanabusa for the race for the U.S. Senate by $1 million. The first printout came out and Hanabusa led 50%. To 47% over Schatz. But then when the neighbor island votes came over, you know, Schatz won by 1,782 votes. So money works. Money worked then, but it sure didn't work for Neil Abercrombie against David Ige.
Right. And then we were chatting earlier, and you had some interesting insight about the voters, you know, neighbor islands versus here on Oahu.
Well, the first printout, I learned from Rex Cadilla, from the Oahu Elections Office, that there are so many early voting and absentee voting that they won't be able to cover them in the first printout, so they probably will have to go to the second and third printout. So that means the impact of the early voters won't be apparent, and the neighbor island votes will become more important as we go, you know, as we look at the whole race. And it's interesting to note, from my perspective, that we have twice as many white people on the neighbor islands as we have in urban Honolulu, and we have twice as many Asians in urban Honolulu than we do in Congressional District 2, which is rural Hawaii. So, you know, the voting
race
on
factor.
the voting on the neighbor islands, and no governor has ever won a race without winning the neighbor islands, and that's going to be key in
All
this
right.
one, I think.
All right. Thanks, Wayne. Thanks for that insight.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. That was HPR's Wayne Yoshioka. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you're tuned to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio on HPR 1. Thank you.
HPR's Atherton Studio on Friday, August 10th. In the hands of the Dehan Ensemble, jazz standards get a hip-hop makeover, and hip-hop tunes find their jazzy style. Reserve your seats today at hprtickets.org and bridge the gap with the Dehan Ensemble, Friday the 10th. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
It's time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Emily Dugdale filed a story about the growing pains of an Oahu charter school after operating for just a year. Hi there, Emily.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so this story is really interesting. I mean, it just kind of details the growing pains. I mean, very tough thing to do to start up a school. Tell us about it.
Absolutely. You know, Kamalani Academy is just this small arts-integrated, Hawaiian-oriented charter school. You know, they just opened with an enrollment of 300 kids and just a teaching staff of 14. And they've just really, this year has really brought open how hard it is for a charter school to get off in Hawaii. I mean, it's just they do not have kind of the built-in structure of a traditional DOE public school. And remember, charter schools are, this is a public charter school, so they do receive some money from the DOE, about a little more than $7,000 per student. And that's all the support they really get. So a lot of this year was just the school really trying to just figure out, you know, how they're supposed to be running things. And that's where some of the problems kind of started.
Right. And you mentioned some problems with teachers and administrators, and they're trying to find their way.
Absolutely. You know, the school started out with, like I said, 14 teachers. And by the end of the year, at least 8 of those teachers did resign. And after the, you know, post, after the school year wrapped up, 2 more teachers did resign from the school. And in speaking to these teachers, you know, many of them did speak to us off the record. They were worried about, you know, retaliation. They were worried about finding jobs afterwards. But it did just kind of seem like a climate of frustration with some other administration. They didn't really feel like they were being supported. And I think the mission of the school, a lot of these teachers are very new to Hawaii Islands. And, you know, they weren't really sure what they were supposed to be doing with all of the, you know, things that they were tasked with in terms of arts integration and Hawaiian culture. The principal, Jeff Velarde, actually did resign several weeks after the school year ended. And, you know, we weren't able to get a comment from him, but we do know that several teachers did present to the governing board of the school with concerns about the principal.
Right. So school is just about to get underway. So I'm sure they're just desperately searching for an administrator.
Absolutely. They do have their student services coordinator stepping in there to fill the gap, but they are currently looking for a full-time principal. And, you know, we did talk to leaders at the school. Kuipa Lamotia is the founder. She's a Native Hawaiian mother living in Wahiwa. And Steve Davidson was the vice president of the governing board. And they did assure us, you know, we're on track. You know, we're feeling good about opening up for year 2. And they do have a longer wait list than last year. So, you know, it seems like it seems like the problems have at some seems to a little bit roll off the back for some people. They do still have quite an interest in the school.
All right. Well, we'll just have to see how they weather this second year. Thanks very much, Emily.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Civil Beat's Emily Dugdale with today's reality check. To read her full story, visit civilbeat.org. This week, community leaders on Molokai renewed the call to protect our endangered Hawaiian monk seal population. It followed the discovery of the death of yet another endangered marine mammal on the Friendly Isle. Since 2009, officials say 8 seals have been killed, they presume at the hands of humans, and the most recent case involved a seal that was just a year old. We thought it was timely to check on the condition of another pup seal, or seal pup, I should say, in a weakened state that was rescued off the coast of Kauai and transferred to the Big Island. Scientists have named him Sole. We talk with Dr. Claire Simeon with the Marine Mammal Center about his progress to date.
So Sole has been here at Ke Kaiola for the past 2 weeks after being transported via one of the U.S. Coast Guard helicopters from Molokai, and he's doing great. He is progressing really well. Everything was normal on his physical exam. He's showing a lot of interest in the live fish that we put in his pool, even though he's not quite fast enough to catch them yet. And so we're giving him a fish milkshake, and his weight is staying stable, and really everything that a normal pup should be doing, he's checking off the list.
And so how much weight has he gained?
Well, he's right now, when animals first come into the hospital, because we have to think about if you've been starving for a long time, you wouldn't immediately want to go and eat a whole bunch of hamburgers. And so we want to increase his food very slowly, starting out with really like an unflavored Gatorade, an electrolyte solution. And so he actually is the same weight when he first came in, but that's to be expected these first couple weeks. And once he starts to eat fish, he'll start to gain anywhere from 1 to 5 pounds a week.
Okay, but he's now on what? Fish milkshakes, you said?
Yep, he's now receiving fish milkshakes. So he's getting tubings 3 times a day. And then we're also giving him small pieces of fish in his pool so that he can learn how to position them and chew them up and learn that swallowing process.
So how did he get to your attention? How did you know that he was in trouble?
Well, you know, anytime we're working with Hawaiian monk seals, an endangered species, it really takes a whole village that's watching over these populations. And so our partners at NOAA Fisheries had an eye on him several weeks before we picked him up, because they had noticed that he had been switched with another pup. And so the pups had switched moms. And monk seals nurse for a specific amount of time, and then they wean their pups and they leave. And so he really got the short end of the stick, because he weaned several weeks earlier than he actually should have. And so thanks to those eyes on the ground, we were able to make a plan and able to transport him here and give him that support that he needs.
Gosh, so what's the plan for his rehabilitation, or his, I don't know what you would call it?
Yeah, absolutely. His rehabilitation is going to continue with providing him lots of high quality nutrition, lots of live fish and other prey items so that he can learn the skills that he needs when he gets back into the wild. And then once he is eating on his own and he's gained weight to be in a good body condition, then we'll work with our partners to return him back into the wild.
And so generally, how long does it take for a little pup like that to kind of bounce back?
You know, it depends on how debilitated they are when they first come in. Sully, actually, because we were able to get to him really quickly, he's really turned the corner very quickly. But the animals tend to be in our care anywhere from about a month to sometimes over 6 or 8 months, depending on a lot of different factors.
Was it tricky during the rescue?
Actually, everything went really smoothly and exactly to plan. It was exciting being on the Coast Guard helicopter and coming down. And luckily, we had our partners on the ground who had already been able to load Sully up into a carrier. He was first put into a beach pen and then into similar, just like a dog carrier. So he was all ready to go. So they didn't even stop the rotors from going. We were able to load him really, really quickly, which helped to speed the process up and to reduce any sort of disturbance to him and minimize it as much as possible.
So I imagine when you undertake a rescue like that, things have to be really mapped out in case something does go wrong, but at least you have a plan.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's really key that everybody is highly trained and knowing, you know, the specific skills that they have. And that's why partnering with the Coast Guard is fantastic, because, you know, they know their piece to be able to get that helicopter into a really remote location. And our partners at NOAA really know how, you know, they know monk seals well and how to interact around them and how to get them loaded up. And then we provide the veterinary support to make sure that he's doing well during that transport, and he did great. He actually, just like a baby would, he actually fell asleep and was snoring for most of the flight.
You mean monk seals snore?
They do.
And I know when we had Kaimana here on Oahu, lots of people were pretty captivated.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, Monk Seals are so charismatic. They have such amazing personalities, and they're such a rare treat to see. And so that's really what we want, is for, you know, the public to love these seals and to really have a great respect for them, because we're lucky to be sharing these islands with them.
You know, when you hear stories about one of the other islands where there were some monk seals that were killed, I'm sure that's probably very frustrating, because here you're trying to save a life and someone's taken one.
It is, absolutely. Absolutely. It's always really sad to hear any time that there's a monk seal death, whether it's intentional or not. And, you know, that any animal just is such a loss for the generations that come down the line. And when you're dealing with such a small population, each individual really counts towards the recovery of the species. And so much of our job is really helping to tell that story of what makes those monk seals so special, so that people really do want to protect what they love.
Tell us about the care of Soleil. I mean, you're watching him 24 hours a day. Do you have enough volunteers down there?
Well, yes. Yeah. So the Marine Mammal Center relies on volunteers. We have animal care volunteers. We have response volunteers who go out and check the beaches and interact with the public, take programming into schools, and we're always looking for more volunteers. We have a crew that is helping our staff to take care of Soleil. You know, when he first came in, he was getting fed four times a day, and it's a lot of work. And so we always welcome more people that are interested in getting involved, because there's a lot to be done to save the species. I think that even though we're on the Big Island here, we have relatively small number of monk seals. But it's a really special place. We're open to the public. We have tours multiple times a week that we can arrange if people want to call to schedule an appointment. And we always welcome sharing these stories of these really incredible animals, because we're so lucky to work with them. And so anytime that we can share that with the public, we jump on that chance.
I imagine the personalities of the seals maybe are a little bit different. Have you been able to figure anything out about Soleil at this point?
You're exactly right. The monk seals all have really interesting and individual personalities, and he is just like a spitfire. He'll bark at things. He chases fish. He rolls around. He's like a little puppy or a toddler. You know, we're always putting new enrichment items in his pool so that something's new, and he goes over to it and he checks it out, and he's really excited. And so he's a fighter. So it's been really fun to see his personality come out as he feels better and better.
And you don't have another monk seal for him to play with, do you?
We don't right now. And that's an important piece, is that we take as many steps as we can to reduce our impact on the monk seals. And so, you know, we stay out of the pens as much as possible. We reduce our contact to a minimum. Ideally, we'd love for him to have another monk seal friend as another patient. And of course, our doors are always open to other monk seals in need. But that's just another piece, that we try to minimize the time that it takes for him to get eating and gaining weight and everything, so he can get back out the door. Because even though monk seals are solitary, they like that stimulus and having other animals around. But we want to make sure that he stays wild and that he has the best chance of survival once he gets back into his home.
That was Dr. Claire Simeon with Kei Kai Ola, the Marine Mammal Center on the Big Island, talking about the progress being made nursing a weak monk seal pup back to health. Earlier in today's show, we asked what newspaper commissioned Mark Twain to write a travel series about the Hawaiian Islands. By 1866, Twain had a national audience through his satirical publication, The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County.
His travel series expanded on his adventures in Hawaii, which included sitting on the Iolani Palace lawn before it was built in 1882 and watching 2,000 Hawaiians grieving by torchlight for Princess Victoria Kamamalu on the eve of her funeral. He wrote about his visit to the family crypt of the Kalakauas and the Kamehamehas and spent weeks exploring the Big Island on horseback. In an attempt to master the art of surfing, Twain later wrote, "I tried surf bathing once, subsequently, but made a failure of it. I got the board placed right and at the right moment, too, but missed the connection myself. None but natives ever master the art of surf bathing thoroughly." In total, he wrote 25 letters as part of the exchange he maintained with the Sacramento Union, a California newspaper. And congratulations to David Matsunaga of Honolulu. He got that answer right. That is today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. In other news from the Big Island, the lava going into the ocean has provided a proving ground for Liquid Robotics, a Boeing company. It created something called a wave glider that's allowed scientists to gather data from offshore waters. That glider just returned back on solid ground this week, and scientists have just started crunching the data they've retrieved. We check in with the Big Island's marine scientist, Steve Colbert, about this effort.
The wave glider by Liquid Robotics, it's about the size of a stand-up paddleboard. On the top of it, there's solar panels and a weather station, and the solar panels are for running all the electronics and instruments. Inside it is a computer and other instruments for measuring water quality, and then down below is a wing that's attached about 16 feet below the surface, and it's the movement of the waves and that caused that wing to kind of pull the wave glider along.
What have you folks learned? I mean, my gosh, this volcano has just been going.
Well, the amount of data is incredible because they're able to get real-time data every 2 minutes, either being sent over the cellular network or through satellite communications. You're getting all this data in near real time. The project that I was interested in was looking at where that hot water is going and how that water has been changed by the lava pouring into the ocean. So we wanted to know if it was going to be moving down and affecting other coastal ecosystems down current from where the lava is pouring into the ocean.
And how deep down are you able to get data?
Well, it's great. The wave glider, that base is about 16 feet below the surface. So we're getting data not just at the surface, but also at 16 feet depth. The wave glider, the Liquid Robotics, was founded here on Hawaii Island, and they've done quite a bit of work. But this is the first time that it's been used to go and explore these plumes of hot water coming from these volcanoes.
Is there any type of camera attached to it where you can get visuals as to what's going on?
Absolutely. I know they have one on the surface, and they might have one deeper down. I think what we've been able to see is how that plume of hot, muddy water has been fluctuating through time almost every day, and it's changes with how much lava is pouring into the ocean. As more lava pours in, the water gets hotter and spreads out more, and other days there's simply less lava going in and not as much hot water. So what we see is water temperatures 100 degrees Fahrenheit 2 miles offshore on some days. The key is that that hot water tends to flow straight offshore instead of along the shoreline. So as the water gets heated up by the lava pouring in, it tends to expand out offshore, and then new seawater comes in either along the shoreline or from below up to replace that, creating this conveyor belt where new ocean water is coming into the shoreline and that hot water is being pushed offshore.
And how long have we deployed this thing?
It was deployed for about 3 weeks, and just a couple days ago, it found its way back to Kauai High Harbor and has been recovered so that they can do analysis of the wave glider after being in these extreme conditions. There was extra data that was collected that was kept on board, and so we're starting to see that extra data now, too, which is really exciting.
I know there was concern, too, about our endangered species, threatened species. You know, I guess there were turtles that were in distress in that area. Do we have any indication about that and what the wave rider might have recorded?
Well, from the wave glider, what we know is that that water is just extremely hot where the lava is pouring in. And for those nearshore ecosystems, that they're probably not able to respond to get out of the way of that hot water, unfortunately, and escape those conditions.
It's pretty exciting stuff, though, when you think we're using this technology to really get some basic science done.
That's the really neat part about this, is that in terms of being able to be out there and collect data continuously over several weeks, that's something that would just be prohibitively expensive and very difficult to pull off from a boat with people on board. This way, we've been able to monitor this situation through time and really get a detailed view of what's going on out there like none other that's been done before.
And there's no indication that this latest phase is ready to, you know, peter out. But what are the plans to deploy this again?
Well, we're going to crunch the data and see what kind of new research questions come from this and see what kind of instruments could possibly be deployed on the wave glider to capture other aspects of this lava flow.
Is it an expensive piece of equipment?
It is. And so that's why we were very fortunate to have Liquid Robotics volunteering their time and personnel to help us to collect this exciting data set.
Any other place in the world where we're doing something like this?
It's certainly the first that I know of where the lava is flowing into the ocean and examining such extreme conditions there. It has measured oxygen. It also measures how muddy the water is and how much chlorophyll there is in the water. It turns out in that really hot water, there doesn't seem to be much chlorophyll, which kind of makes sense. Everything seems to get cooked in that hot water. The oxygen concentrations, they seem to be a little bit lower in that muddy water, which probably from some of the reduced material that gets into the water from the lava flow.
Any problems with that wave glider coming in contact with, let's say, any of the lava tour boats?
No, it has sensors on it so that it can be identified.
Is it just kind of going along the shoreline?
We did a zigzag pattern going about 2 miles, 2.5 miles offshore, back and forth across where the lava is pouring into the ocean. The remarkable thing about this plume of this hydrothermal plume is just how sharp the boundaries are at the edges. And with this real-time data, with this real high-resolution data, collecting data in some cases every second, we're really able to define what those boundaries between the hydrothermal water and the deep blue Pacific water, what that boundary is like. The wave glider can go as far out to sea as they want to ask it to. It's traveled from San Francisco to Hawaii Island and all over the Pacific. That's really one of the great parts about it is that you can kind of just set it to go where you want it to. From the safety of your home, the wave glider is able to navigate the storms, navigate through nighttime, and keep safe while it's out there, while we stay safe at home.
What's been the most remarkable thing about this for you?
For me, it's that real-time high getting data every minute, every 2 minutes, and being able to see how the conditions are changing out there over such short distances and in such short periods of time as the wave glider goes along. You know, that whole stretch of shoreline is just such an important was such an important place ecologically and such a beautiful place to begin with. It really was a loss. And it was just this shoreline with all these little tide pools in it. And, you know, the fish that were in those tide pools, it was likely just as that hot water came in or as lava started to pour into those tide pools, the fish and coral and turtles really didn't have time to respond to any of those high temperatures.
We often hear about how, you know, dogs are very sensitive to earthquakes, and you almost kind of wonder if our marine life can somehow sense that something's changing.
Oh, it's so noisy. We went out there on a boat one day, and we had hydrophones with us, so we could hear what was going on underwater. And it's very noisy with all the pops and explosions of the lava pouring in, and you could hear rocks tumbling down into deeper water. So if there were fish that were sensitive to that, and they may keep away from it. But there's some fish that are very territorial, and they don't go away from their home location. So it's possible that they may be resistant to leaving. And then all the critters that live on the seafloor, the crabs, the coral, the sea cucumbers, they don't have a chance of getting away from anything like that.
That was University of Hawaii marine scientist Steve Colbert talking about the work ahead to analyze data collected from the lava hitting the ocean. He hopes to have a preliminary report for Liquid Robotics, that company that provided the wave glider, in the weeks to come, with formal findings to be released at a later date.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
That's it for this week. Next week, we'll be talking super PACs. Call in and join the conversation. Do you belong to one of the unions funding the political action committees? Do you agree with how your dues are being spent? This program is produced by Lillian Tsang, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Congrusby. This week, we bid aloha to our interns, Harrison Patino and Savannah Harriman-Pope. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday and pick up the conversation.